Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Immigration has become one of the most contentious issues in American politics today. There are a growing number of Americans who say that they are worried that immigrants pose a threat both to American society and to American security. However, our guest for this hour, Princeton University sociologist Douglas Massey, says that he believes this fear is misplaced. He says that the movement of people, particularly from Mexico into the United States, is a natural result of the economic integration of the two countries. And instead of building walls, he says what we should be thinking about is ways that we can make this natural movement benefit everybody who is concerned. In this first hour of the show today, we will consider this question: does America have an immigration crisis? And our guest is Doug Massey from the Department of Sociology at Princeton. He will be here in Champaign-Urbana next week on Thursday, the 11th, to give a talk on this subject in the MillerCom series. It's a series of talks that have been going on here on this campus for a long time. They are always free and open to the public, so if you're interested, you certainly should feel welcome. He will be giving his talk on Thursday afternoon, October 11th at 4, in the Knight Auditorium. That's in the Spurlock Museum on the campus. That's 600 South Gregory Street. So, as I say, if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana, you'd like to hear him, you certainly can do that. But here this morning on the program, we'll try to talk about some of the same issues and give you the opportunity to be involved here in the conversation by calling in. Questions, comments are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are brief, and we ask that so that we can keep moving, get in as many different people as possible. But certainly you're welcome to be involved in the conversation. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number to call is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. So if you're listening on the air or on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, that number will work for you. So again, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. And our guest, Douglas Massey, is speaking to us this morning from Princeton. Professor Massey, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Let me just, as a way of just starting out, let me ask that question straight out. Do you think that America does indeed have an immigration crisis?
Well, I do think we have an immigration crisis right now, but I also think it's largely a crisis of our own making. The movement of people back and forth across the Mexico-U.S. border has been going on for 100 years, and the volume really hasn't changed that much over time. And over the past two decades, we've grown more and more close and more economically integrated with Mexico. And that flow is a normal part, and it works in both ways. There are a million Americans living in Mexico at present as well. What's strange is to militarize the border with a friendly trading nation that poses no conceivable military threat and no real security threat. There are no Islamic populations or Islamic terrorist cells in Mexico. So what's strange is the militarization of this border, and that has created the crisis.
Well, it does. Then if we're talking about crisis, we're using that term, then are you suggesting that it's a crisis? In a sense, it's an emotional crisis. It's a crisis because we think it is one. But in fact, if you take a look at things like the impact on culture, the impact on the economy, demand on social services, all those concerns that people bring up, then in fact, those aren't as much of a problem as the way that we feel about what's going on.
Well, I do think there is a very real crisis because we've got an unprecedentedly large undocumented population in the United States. One-third of all immigrants in the U.S. are now out of status. One-half of all Mexican immigrants are out of status. This is an untenable situation, and it creates a large population that is really eminently exploitable and not good for American workers and American citizens, not good for the immigrants themselves. And how we got into that situation, I think, is something of our own making. Because when we militarized the border between Mexico and the United States, all that enforcement had the perverse effect not of stopping the inflows, but of discouraging people from returning once they were here. We did drive up the costs and risks of border crossing substantially. And migrants naturally responded rationally by minimizing border crossing. And they did that by hunkering down and staying once they've run the gauntlet at the border. In the past, they would have gone home knowing that they could re-enter if they needed to in the future. Now they just stay here. And so what's happened since the early 1990s is the rate of return migrations fallen by half. And that's another way of saying the net rate of undocumented migration has increased by two, a factor of two.
Well, it seems that at the moment, I think that this issue is we're not probably going anywhere with it, at least until probably we have a change of presidential administration. But it seemed that the conversation was deadlocked between those people on the one hand who were arguing for, who were saying this essentially is a legal problem. They were arguing for greater enforcement, either by putting people on the border or putting up fences, and to come down hard on people who were found to be in the United States illegally, undocumented. So between people on that side and people on the other side, and saying this is a reality that we simply have to acknowledge, the people are here. There's no way that we could round them all up and send them home, even if we wanted to. Our economy depends on their labor. So what we need is to have some kind of a policy that makes sense, some kind of, and what the president has proposed is something that amounts to a kind of a guest worker program so that these people can be here legally, can work, can have legal protection. And it seems that at least for the moment, the people that are on the build the wall side of the conversation have the upper hand. And so that's sort of where we are.
Well, I think the politicians are more divided than the American people. According to public opinion polls, substantial majorities favored immigration reform, favored some kind of legalization program, favored a guest worker program, favored regularizing these flows. But there is a strong, very vocal, and very angry wing of the Republican Party, particularly, that is adamantly opposed to any accommodation with immigration. And they managed to mobilize politically to carry the day. They scared enough of the representatives to really thwart the will of the majority of the American people.
Do you think that that's something that is likely to change anytime soon?
Not as long as media entrepreneurs and political entrepreneurs can see a gain by demonizing immigrants and preying upon Americans' well-founded insecurities, economic insecurities and political insecurities in an age of rising terrorism, preying upon those insecurities by demonizing immigrants and using them as scapegoats. It works at some level, and until it stops working, politicians will continue to do it.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Douglas Massey. He's professor of sociology at Princeton University, and in his research looks at issues like race and ethnicity and international migration. We're talking this morning about immigration and the problem of illegals here in the United States, something that, as I said at the beginning, in the last year or so at least has been a very contentious political issue. He is going to be here giving a talk on the subject next week on the U of I campus. And questions here this morning on Focus are certainly welcome. We have one person here who's up and ready to go, and certainly others are welcome to call. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. First caller is in St. Charles, and this is on our toll free line 4. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is a big concern of mine. I'll tell you, it's a big concern, like you brought out, in country from a lot of Americans. And having grown up in California, I'm born and bred out, raised out there up until about 15 years ago I came out here. I used to live in Palm Springs. And I'll tell you what, to this day, my folks still live out there, but to this day you can run across the border like it's no big deal. Now, if people out there say it's not an issue, it is an issue. Having been hit in 9/11, I lost a friend over there in the trade towers. And I'll tell you what, if you don't think this isn't a problem, then I don't know which world you came from, because it is a problem. And it's not just Hispanics coming over here. Now, do we let this go on? I mean, what's it going to take? What say the next time we get hit? You know, here's the point I'm trying to bring. We have a problem with this country of giving money to other countries, giving money to any way, you know, any, it seems like any country or any persons that in need it. Yet at the same time, we got a struggling economy. All right. I'm in the service industry and I'm losing money every day because people don't want to spend it on doing things anymore. Why? because there's no money out there. We're sending money out left and right, but we won't take care of our own kind. And it's solely, the reason I bring this up, it seems to me it's a welfare issue. I mean, I've known this for a long time, that a lot of my friends are using illegals just because they don't have to pay taxes, just because who's going to trace them down? They know the government can't do it. So why are they, instead of paying somebody $10 an hour to paint walls, for instance, he's paying him $4 or $5 an hour. Now, is that fair to the illegals? No. I mean, the more we take advantage of these people, and I feel for them, I really do. But the issue is, how far do you go before the economy starts sinking because of it? We got baby boomers retirement. I'm trying to wrap this into the baby boomers retiring. Where's all the money going to come from?
Well, let's get some response from the guests, and I don't know how you want to take that, but it's certainly one of the concerns that the caller raised, and a lot of people have, is the issue of border security, and it's certainly not just an issue along the border with Mexico. It's also an issue along the border with Canada, although we don't seem to talk about that quite as much. We, in both cases, have these long borders where there are places where there's nobody and nothing, and there seems to be no real problem with crossing the border. How worried do you think we should be about this issue purely on a security basis?
Well, I think way too much attention is focused on the southern border of the United States. What I like to say is we've already militarized that border more than any other peaceful border between any two countries in the world. And militarizing that border, which occurred before 9/11, had no impact whatsoever on 9/11. None of the hijackers came across that border. None of the hijackers had anything to do with Mexico. In fact, if you look at who got killed on 9/11, in addition to American citizens, there were large numbers of immigrants, some of whom were even undocumented, working in the trade towers on that day. So it's like we've already built a wall on our southern border, one wall, and we want to double it and add to it and build another wall and strengthen it and spend more money. Meanwhile, we've got no wall on either side of our country and our back door's flapping wide open, and we think by putting more money on that border, we're going to make ourselves more secure. But it's just a waste of money as far as I'm concerned. I think we need, if we were to devote more money to security in our ports and our coasts and to the northern border, we would enhance our security to a much greater degree. There are no terrorist cells in Mexico. There are terrorist cells in Canada. There are no Islamic populations in Mexico. There are Islamic populations in Canada. If you were al-Qaeda, where would you try to enter the United States? Tijuana, where you face the most militarized border anywhere in the peaceful world? Or would you go to Toronto, blend in with an indigenous Islamic community, and at your leisure row across the lake on an undefended border?
What about the economic impact of immigrants? And I guess that really this gets complicated because we are talking about, on the one hand, the economic impact of people who are here who are undocumented. But then, would there still, even if we made it possible for these people to be here legally and they would be paying taxes and they would be paying Social Security, would we still be having a concern about wages for American citizens being driven down because these people were working here, admittedly legally, but maybe for a lower wage?
Well, I think if the people here in illegal status were to somehow acquire a legal status, and if a guest worker program was set up and guest worker programs were given full protections within U.S. labor markets with full rights of other U.S. workers, then they would no longer be exploitable. We have seen some downward pressure on wages and working conditions in the United States at the low end of the labor market particularly. But I think this is largely an artifact of the growth of this very exploitable population over time and the increase in its exploitability over time. The trick is to manage our immigration affairs better so that American workers are protected and the immigrant workers are protected. I think a sign of movement in this direction is that labor unions have come around to this point of view. Historically, labor unions tended to be anti-immigration. Now they are for immigration reform because they see that giving immigrants rights in the United States will protect American workers and will also allow them an opportunity to organize them into unions.
Let's talk with another. I appreciate the comments of the last call. Let's talk with somebody else here locally where we are in Champaign and line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. How are you guys?
Good.
I just have a kind of a two-pronged question, and then I'll hang up and listen to perhaps your views on it. One is that with the exploitability of these illegal workers, they're unsafe here in the U.S. facing persecution because if they get found out or caught, they're deported. But two, they want to earn money and then bring it home to their families, and they're also being persecuted basically by the Mexican police on the other side of the border where they're trying to smuggle money back home to feed their families, where they're actually being robbed by the government and the authorities on the south side of the border. And then secondly, how can we tax what these illegals are making? A lot of times they claim many dependents, which therefore they don't pay taxes. And then before they leave the country, before they have to pay taxes annually. I'll hang up now and see how you guys choose to respond. Thank you.
Well, police corruption in Mexico has historically been a problem, although I think as far as immigrants go, it's gotten a lot better. Starting in the late 1980s under the presidency of Carlos Salinas and continuing up to the present, the Mexican government's done a lot to try to ensure and protect the rights of returning migrants. They launched in 1988 something called Programa Bracero, which regularized and limited what customs officials could do to returning migrants from the United States. If you travel to Mexico, you'll notice that now when you come into the country, you push a little button and it activates a red light, green light system. And the thing is pre-programmed to randomly give a red light about 10% of the time. And this was instituted to protect migrants because now customs officials can't just spot out migrants and then shake them down when they come back. They can't search them unless they get a red light, and that happens only 10% of the time, and half the time, most of the time it's for some kind of American tourist who's coming in. This is part of the mechanism that the state of Mexico put in place to try to protect its migrants. As far as taxes, we will have very incomplete tax collections as long as a large segment of the population is in undocumented status, working through subcontractors, and being paid in cash. That's why it's so important to regularize it, bring it above board, and we also have to concentrate a lot of our enforcement not against the migrants themselves, but also against the employers. Personally, I'm for a better employer verification program that would actually serve to prevent undocumented hiring.
I think that one of the questions that people have, or maybe one of the concerns that people have, is that as a part of whatever it is we do to make it possible for people who are now here illegally to be here legally to work, and this, the way we've talked about it, it makes it sound as if what we are talking about is it's some kind of temporary guest worker program that would allow people to be here to work for some period of time, but then after that they would be required to go back to their country of origin for some period of time before they could come back. And I think that one of the things that people really argue about is whether or not there should be or could be some mechanism here for people to start to work to become citizens. And I guess one of the things that I wonder about is for people who do come here to work, that's their idea, to work and then also to send a lot of that money home, how many people actually are thinking about being citizens, or the idea is that they are coming to the United States to improve their economic condition, to make money, but then their idea is eventually to return to Mexico and to live in Mexico and not to become American citizens?
Well, the motivation for the typical Mexican immigrant when they start migrating to the United States is really to solve a problem at home. And they have a short-term plan to come to the United States to work for some fixed period of time, 12 months, 18 months, 2 years, something like that, save up money or send money back to solve the problem that motivated them to migrate in the first place. And the biggest single motivation for migration to the United States is the desire to acquire or purchase a house in the absence of decent mortgage markets in Mexico. And given their druthers, most migrants would work for a short period of time and return. Perhaps they'll return once more or twice more to solve another problem. But historically, the vast majority of people that began migrating in this way returned. Now, it's also true that there's no such there's nothing more permanent than a temporary worker program. And what that means is that some fraction of people always acquire ties in the course of migrating and working. They come to acquire a strong relationship with an employer, and the employer wants to continue to employ them, and he wants to sponsor them. Or they meet and marry an American citizen. There are lots of reasons why people would decide to settle permanently instead of return. So I see immigration reform as basically having three components. First, we need to increase the size of the legal quota for Mexico. The quota for Mexico is the same as for every other country in the world, 20,000 visas per year, legal quota. But Mexico is a $1 trillion economy, 105 million people. There are a million Americans in Mexico, 10 million Mexicans in the United States, massive traffic back and forth. And yet it has the same legal quota as Botswana. It just doesn't make any sense. Second thing we need to do is to legalize the large population that is built up here. We've dug ourselves into an untenable hole at this point, and we need to do something about it. 12 million people out of status is not good for us. We can do this with a combination of different kinds of legalizations. About 3 million of the people here in illegal status are people who entered as minors. They entered as children, and they've grown up here. And they're guilty of no crime except obeying their parents, and I think as long as they don't have a criminal record, they should be given an immediate and unconditional amnesty to let them get on with their lives. For people who entered as adults, I would favor some kind of combination of earned legalization program where you acquire points towards ultimate legalization and permanent residence. Or some people will simply opt for a guest worker visa. They don't want to stay here permanently, and they'll be happy to legalize for 2 years and then go home. So I think between those different kinds of legalization programs, we could get somewhere. And finally, I think we need some kind of a permanent, ongoing guest worker program to satisfy the labor demand in the United States and accommodate the natural motivation of most migrants to only work here temporarily and then go home. If we bring it above board, we can tax it. We can use the tax revenues to offset the costs that migrants bring with them because they, of course, are human beings and do have human needs. And we can charge them a fee up front to pay for the guest worker program and set up an insurance pool so that they don't show up in hospitals uninsured. We know they're willing to pay $1,200 to get into the United States. Right now it's going into smugglers. If we could recapture that money and use it for good purposes, it would benefit everybody.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Douglas Massey. He is a sociologist at Princeton University. In his research, he looks at subjects like international migration and Latin American society, particularly Mexico. He will be visiting the campus of the University of Illinois next week and will be giving a talk on the subject, Understanding America's Immigration Crisis. It's a talk in the MillerCom series. This will be Thursday afternoon, 4 o'clock, in the Knight Auditorium in the Spurlock Museum on the U of I campus on South Gregory. And anyone who's interested should feel free to stop by and hear what he has to say. And here on the program, questions are welcome, certainly. We'd like to get people into the conversation. You have questions, comments, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think that one of the things that at least people who are concerned about how it is we deal with those people who are undocumented, who are here now, the thing that they talk a lot about is this feeling that in coming here illegally, what they have done is broken the law, and that there ought to be some kind of sanction. I suppose some people would say, well, really, what we should do is they should be arrested and deported. At the very least, there should be some kind of consequence for their breaking the law, and that's for a lot of people who oppose this idea of the guest worker program for people who are here illegally. That's one of the things that they talk about. They say, well, if we do that, they literally use the term amnesty. We are granting people amnesty who have committed crimes, and that we should not and cannot do that.
Well, that's why I broke the undocumented population into two groups. For people who entered the country as minors, sometimes when they're 2 or 3 years old, how can you not give them an amnesty? They didn't do anything wrong. They were brought here by their parents. And if they've grown up, speak English, graduated from high school, and have no criminal record, then I favor an amnesty. For people who entered as adults or came in legally and fell into illegal status, sometimes it's not even your fault when that happens. They've transgressed the law, and I don't favor an immediate amnesty, but they should be given a chance, if they wish to earn the right to stay here. Let's recall that lots of things are illegal. Not all of them are criminal. So if I don't put money in a meter and I get a ticket, I've broken the law, but that's not a criminal offense. Likewise, under current law, crossing the border without documents is not a criminal offense. It's a civil offense. And the people that are migrating have no criminal intent. They are responding to a demand for their labor in the United States. And the big problem is basically a mismatch between what our country actually demands in the way of workers and the ability of our immigration system under current law to accommodate that demand.
We have other callers here. Let's go again to the phones. Next person in line is in Terre Haute, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Yes. I just wanted to ask a brief, what your thoughts are. I have a friend of mine who's from Mexico. I live out in Washington. He had come up there, he had formed a family, and back across the border so he could.
Caller, I'm sorry. We're losing you. We're periodically dropping out, and we're not getting all of your comments. Can you hear me? Well, I think we actually lost the caller. I'll tell you what. What we can do is suggest that he can try calling back, and we'll see if we can get him. In the meantime, why don't we go to another caller? And next, that will be. Let me see. Well, let's go to line number 2. This is Urbana. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I had a question about a particular statistic. I understand that there are immigrants who are being paid wages under a dead person's Social Security number. So I assume that that would mean that those wages are being taxed at least by the Social Security system, and the money is going into the Social Security system, whether or not they claim a large number of dependents so that they don't have to pay federal tax. They are actually paying into the Social Security system. So I wonder if you have any statistic on the percentage of immigrants who actually are paying into the Social Security system in some fashion.
Well, according to the data that I've collected, I've done extensive interviews among undocumented migrants in the United States. A substantial majority are paying taxes into the system. The sharing of Social Security numbers and the use of fake Social Security numbers and the use of dead people's Social Security numbers is relatively common as a way to work in the United States, give a Social Security number, and then have the taxes deducted. Of course, if it's a shared Social Security number or somebody's a dead person's Social Security number or a made-up Social Security number, they're not going to file a tax return. And so when the National Research Council, the National Academy of Sciences, did a study in the late 1990s, they found that there was this huge inflow of revenues to the federal government through undocumented migrants that was unclaimed and basically a subsidy to the United States. Now, most of the analyses that have been done show that there's a net fiscal benefit to immigration for the United States. The problem is a transfer problem. The benefits accrue mainly to the nation as a whole. The tax revenues accrue mainly to the federal government, but all the costs are paid locally. It's the county and city who pay the hospital bills, the school bills, the police bills, the fire bills, the health bills, all those things. And the federal government currently, under current law, has nothing in its revenue sharing formula to take account of the fact that some parts of the country are required to pay a lot more to integrate immigrants for the benefit of the rest of the nation. And what I would favor would be to put some kind of trigger in federal revenue sharing formulas that would make more money available to localities with lots of immigrants.
Great answer. Thank you so much for the information.
All right. Thank you. Let's go next to Savoy. The next caller here, line number 1. Hello.
Hi. Good morning. Mm-hmm. Thanks for the program. I just wanted to offer observation. I live up in Rantoul, and we have a large Latino influx in our community up there, and I assume most of those folks are legal, but I don't know. But I just wanted to say that, you know, they've really, I think that folks immigrating are really going to help our country in the long run because, you know, as a whole, as I, you know, notice that they're very hardworking folks and they're very family-oriented, and I think they're going to really be a big plus for our country down the road. So I just wanted to offer that insight, and thank you very much.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Professor Massey, you want to comment on that in any way?
Well, after working with immigrants for 30 years, that's generally my experience and impression of what immigration is all about. And if you look at the city of Chicago, for example, and look at the heavily Mexican neighborhoods, the heavily immigrant neighborhoods, you find that they have among the lowest rates of crime in the city of Chicago. So the idea that immigrants are bringing crime into the United States doesn't hold up under scrutiny.
It does seem, I suppose, that there are some people who raise questions about immigrants, people who come from Mexico or from wherever, the values sort of issue, and saying either do these people share whatever you think that is, what America's values are, is there some kind of challenge or threat to American values because we are having people come in?
The people that come in basically are looking to work hard to make a better life for themselves and their families, which is one of the oldest American values. It's driven immigration for hundreds of years. And if they choose to settle here, I think the evidence is that they become very patriotic Americans. If you look at the data for who's serving in Iraq right now, you will find that Latinos are very overrepresented compared to their share in the population. Some are even serving in as undocumented migrants in hopes of becoming citizens. In my experience, immigrants who decide to settle here and become American citizens become very patriotic Americans.
Let's talk next with someone else. Prairie Creek is the next caller, line 4. Hello.
Good morning. Another really great program. From news reports, it seems that there was an influx of migration after NAFTA because of the fact that grain prices were subsidized by the federal government, and that they could actually import corn into Mexico cheaper than they could grow it themselves, and so that a lot of people were out of work in Mexico. I wonder now that grain prices have gone sky high, has that had a reverse effect?
Well, it's really hard to measure these things on a real-time basis. I'm always in the field collecting data, but I'm always about 1 or 2 years out of date. We do know that after the provisions of NAFTA kicked in and protections and subsidies were removed, there was an outflow of migrants from areas that before hadn't been sending very many migrants to the United States. But this was a kind of a short-lived one-shot phenomenon, and I think things have stabilized now. And I do suspect that as grain prices have risen, that it could generate additional employment in rural areas of Mexico. It was basically a one-time shock when you switch from one economic system to another. It's going to displace a lot of people. And that's what happened in Mexico around 1992, 93, 94.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thanks. So just to underscore this, because I think this is a question that's often raised, you don't think it's the case that these economic trade agreements that were intended to draw the two economies closer together, at least that was what advocates would have said, did not necessarily contribute to, didn't undercut the economy of Mexico, making Mexicans poorer, and then as a result, in a sense, forcing more Mexicans to come to the United States to look for work because they weren't able to find work that they could survive and feed their families on in Mexico.
I don't think NAFTA per se is much of a factor in driving migration between Mexico and the United States. I think NAFTA was an imperfect vehicle, and it's the benefits of a broader economic integration have been less than fully realized. The idea that somehow NAFTA was going to prevent migration, I think, was completely misplaced from the start. Politicians said that because they wanted to pass the bill, but that was never a legitimate justification for the North American Free Trade Agreement. What happens in the course of economic integration is contacts are made between trading nations. People come into contact with one another. Transportation and communications costs fall. New links are formed. And all those things make cross-border movements of people more rather than less likely. It's very difficult to integrate the North American market and arrange for the greater cross-border movement of all factors of production with the sole exception of labor. That's why I argue that rather than trying to stamp it out, we should try to accommodate it, regularize it, and manage it in ways that are beneficial to everyone. The experiment we've done for the past 10 years, I think, by all accounts, has been a dismal failure, and it's time to try something different.
We have some other callers. Next, we'll talk with someone in Chicago, line 3. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mm-hmm. I apologize ahead of time. I don't remember the name of this gentleman from Guatemala, but I wondered if you heard about the case where he had worked in this country for 10 years, 10 or 11 years, saved his money, and he got ready to go back to Guatemala, and the government found that he had $59,000. They let him go, but because he failed to file taxes, I guess you didn't know about it, they kept all his money. Did you hear about that?
No, I haven't heard that one. So I don't know anything about the particulars of the case. The Guatemalans, as a population, have been, I think, particularly unfairly treated. Many came in during the height of the Cold War in the mid-1980s, when the U.S. was funding counterinsurgencies in Nicaragua, but also in Guatemala and Salvador. And many people fled and escaped the violence and the social disorder that was out of that conflict.
We do have an immigration problem, but it seems to me, and I'm as pro-American as anyone, but it seems to me that why don't you just give the guy a fine, maybe a $10,000 fine, and let him keep the rest of his money?
Well,
I mean, take the whole money, take the whole thing.
I would agree with you completely.
It just doesn't seem fair. I think someone is being... It reminds me of those old days when they would stop someone, supposedly at the airport, because they fit a profile, and they said, "Where did you get all this money?" "Well, we're going to confiscate it. You have 30 days to appeal, otherwise we're going to keep it."
No, I agree with you completely
on
that.
They put an end to that nonsense, and I just, even though I think that we have a problem with immigration, that just doesn't seem right to me that they would keep all this man's money. He did work hard.
No, I agree. But let me finish the story about the Guatemalan people. They fled here, and Congress kind of got badgered into giving them temporary protected status. Nicaraguans who were fleeing a left-wing regime were pretty much granted an easy path to permanent resident status, but Salvadorans and Guatemalans, because they were fleeing more conservative right-wing regimes, were kind of grudgingly accepted, given something called temporary protected status. And then when the Cold War ended and the conflicts in Central America wound down, Congress suddenly revoked temporary protected status. So many Guatemalans ended up living here for 10 or 15 years, working legally in the United States, buying houses, having kids, and then suddenly Congress says, oops, the violence in Guatemala is over, temporary protected status is revoked, you have 30 days to leave. Well, not surprisingly, a lot of those people didn't leave, and because their new home was here. And your friend could have fallen, or that person that you mentioned could have fallen into that category.
Well,
which
it's
been extremely unfair.
It's possible. Just one more question, then I'll get out of the way. What did you think of the way the government behaved in the Ellie and Gonzalez case?
Well, I think the parental rights are the rights that are the rights that need to be respected. So I didn't like soldiers coming in and taking him, but I think the father had the right to claim his son given the mother's death.
We want to thank the last caller. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Douglas Massey. He is a professor of sociology at Princeton University, and in his research deals with these kinds of issues that we're talking about here, international migration, Latin American society, particularly Mexico. He'll be on the U of I campus next week to give a talk on this very subject, on America's immigration crisis, that in quotes. And questions here are welcome. We have a couple, and we'll try to get in as many as we can in the time that remains. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. The next two callers are in Champaign, and we'll take them in order. First, line number 1.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I have a quick question. Are there going to be requirements that businesses pay the immigrants' legal wages? Because I always, full wages or better wages, because I've always heard they didn't get paid very well.
Well, when they're in illegal status, of course, they're very exploitable, and some significant fraction, do get paid below legal minimum wage. And presumably, if in an immigration reformer, if they're given legal status, then the employers would be compelled to pay according to U.S. labor standards. Since we don't know what immigration reform is actually going to look like, it's a little hard to make a prediction, but certainly that is what I would hope for.
Thank you.
All right, and we'll go to another caller here. This is Champagne, also line two. Hello.
Yes, sir. I just read a book that was once on the New York Times bestseller list. I think it's dropped off since then. It's Outrage by Dick Morris and Eileen McGann. And I got to the immigration section, and the source of that outrage was not so many Mexicans coming over or Latin Americans coming over the southern border, but they come up with this thesis that half of all illegal immigration in this country, or illegal immigrants in this country, came in legally by way of visas and simply have stayed, overstayed their visa. And therefore, their outrage is we have no way of tracing those people and deporting them. Is that your understanding of, quote, our immigration crisis?
Well, the undocumented population is made up of people who ended up being in the country in two ways. You're right. About 40% of the undocumented population didn't cross a border illegally. They crossed the border legally with some kind of document and then subsequently violated the terms of their visa. And so this is a population that doesn't get nearly as much attention as the population of undocumented border crossers, but it's a very serious issue. And the U.S. Immigration system is not very well administered. And believe it or not, we haven't had any exit control since 1957. So we make no attempt, really, to collect any information on people leaving the United States, which makes it very difficult to trace what happens to people after they get here. There's some kind of half-hearted attempts that require people to file if they a certain form when they leave the country. But that's very imperfectly collected, very imperfectly enforced. And you could enter on a plane, required to give up your visa, hand in your visa, and then you could depart through a land border and never be asked for it. So there's a lot of slippage in the system.
Yeah, and of course their outrage is even more pronounced is because I think some of the 9/11 hijackers, in fact, did come to the United States with visas. And their visas expired, and of course there was no way of tracking them down, and we see what that led to.
Yeah, that's exactly right. All the 9/11 hijackers entered the United States on legal visas, and some were illegal at the time they rammed the planes into the towers, and some were expired at the time they ran their planes into the towers.
All right. Well, thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you. Again, another caller here. This is also Champagne, and it's line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I think... you've heard recently of the Mexican who's serving in our war for us. He's on his third tour of duty, and they're trying to ship his wife back to Mexico. I think that's terrible. Do you know if he's getting any help with this?
Well, I think a number of immigrant advocacy groups and legal groups have come forward to try to protect his wife. But I agree with you. It seems unconscionable that somebody is on a third tour of duty in Iraq risking their lives, and they're trying to deport his wife from the United States.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have about 4 or 5 minutes here. Maybe we could talk for just a moment about the language issue, because, again, that is something that seems to concern at least some people, increasing numbers of Spanish speakers, as if that somehow would jeopardize the notion that... that English is the predominant language, the most commonly spoken language, the language of business and commerce and media. Do you think that there is any real reason to be concerned if we have increasing numbers of Spanish speakers coming into the United States?
No, I don't. English is really under no threat within the United States. In fact, even internationally, English has never been as hegemonic as it is now. It's the international language of commerce, of business, of science, of popular culture. Everyone knows that English is the lingua franca of the world. Mexicans know this. And if you go around Mexico, every little town has a English language academy, and way more Mexicans know how to speak English than Anglo-Americans know how to speak Spanish. The question about large numbers of Spanish speakers in the United States, well, of course you have larger numbers of Spanish speakers during a period of rapid immigration. People who enter the country as adults are never going to learn English with the same fluency as a native-born American. Over time, they will pick up a knowledge of English and improve their facility in English, of course. But the real question is what happens to their children. And if you look at their children, overwhelmingly they're English dominant. We did a survey in Southern California, in San Diego and Los Angeles counties, which has the highest density of Spanish speakers almost anywhere in the country. And we found that by the second generation, only 35% of the kids could even speak Spanish with any reasonable facility, and virtually all were English dominant.
We're coming to the point now where we just have a couple of minutes left, and again, as a way of coming around to some kind of point where we can at least finish up, I think that we've done a pretty good job of exploring the landscape of this argument and the various terms of the argument, the questions that people raise on both sides, and it seems that's where we've been for some time now, and I guess I'm back to this idea, wondering, do you think that we are likely anytime soon, anytime at least in the next couple of years, to have some kind of movement on this issue, or will we, a year from now, are we still going to be having, could we do the same interview a year from now and be in the same place?
Well, I got a PhD and I'm a professor at Princeton, but my crystal ball is probably not any better than anybody else's. What I think it will take to move forward on this issue is some political courage. Someone has to stand up to all the demagoguery that's going on, and the blaming of immigrants for virtually every ill in America, and to move forward in a humane and rational fashion. And I think you can lay out the case, as I've tried to do here today, that an immigration reform package is in everybody's interest. It will help American workers, help the United States, help our closest neighbor, Mexico, and, of course, help the immigrants themselves.
Is there some argument to be made that, yeah, and certainly that it does, immigration does pose some significant challenges, and that perhaps for some parts of the country more than others, particularly the border states, those states that border border Mexico. I don't know that anybody's really worried about the states that border Canada. That's the focus is on the southern border, not the northern border. That you really could make the argument that, yeah, that there are some issues here and that these states, their governments, state and local governments, do indeed need help in dealing with those. I suppose in a sense you touched on that earlier when you talked about the fact that, yeah, if there's benefit to the American economy and to this big in-migration, it's to the federal government, to the nation as a whole, and that states and localities do end up paying the bills.
Yeah, and I think that's why states should be strong supporters of immigration reform. And if we can bring these populations above board, capture their tax revenues in a forthright way, and then transfer some of these revenues back to the states and localities who have large immigrant populations, it will certainly be in their interest to do that.
Mm-hmm. And there, though, again, there, the likelihood that would require action by Congress.
Congress, the Constitution gives Congress sole authority over immigration matters.
Hmm. Well, at that, we will have to stop for this time, at least, with a reminder once again that our guest here this morning, Douglas Massey, professor of sociology at Princeton, will be here in Champaign-Urbana on the campus next week to give a talk on this very subject. They've titled it Understanding America's Immigration Crisis. This is a talk in the MillerCom series. They're always open to the public and free, so if you're interested in hearing more on the subject, it's Thursday afternoon, October 11th, 4 p.m. in the Knight Auditorium. That's in the Spurlock Museum on the campus on South Gregory Street. So you should definitely feel welcome to stop by. And you also might look for some of the writing that our guest has done on the issue, particularly maybe the Smoke and Mirrors, U.S. Immigration Policy in the Age of Globalization. That would be one of his recent works that you could take a look at. Professor Massey, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.